knew shit. It was his specialty, the smell in particular, but also the numerous varieties of texture and taste. Someday he'd give a lecture on the topic, put on a suit and tie and stand in front of the Kiwanis Club and tell the fuckers about all the wonderful shit he knew. Pass out samples, maybe. Smiling at this, he clamped the steering wheel slightly right of center, which produced a smooth clockwise motion against the curve of the road. The Chevy seemed to know its own way. The sun was lower now. 5:55, he decided. 6 o'clock, tops. Along an unused railway spur, four workmen labored in the shadowy red heat, setting up a platform and steel launchers for the evening fireworks. They were dressed alike in khaki trousers, work shirts, visor caps, and brown boots. Their faces were dark and smudgy. "Want to hear about the Silver Star I almost won?" Norman Bowker whispered, but none of the workmen looked up. Later they would blow color into the sky. The lake would sparkle with reds and blues and greens like a mirror, and the picnickers would make low sounds of appreciation. "Well, see, it never stopped raining," he would have said. "The muck was everywhere. You couldn't get away from it." He would have paused a second. Then he would have told about the night they bivouacked in a field along the Song Trabon, a big swampy field beside the river. There was a vill nearby, 50 meters downstream, and right away a dozen old mamasans ran out and started yelling. "A crazy scene," he would have said. "The mamasans just stood there in the rain, soaking wet, yapping away about how this field was bad news. 10, they said. Evil ground. Not good spot for good GIs." Finally, Lieutenant Jimmy Cross had to get out his pistol and fire off a few rounds just to shoo them away. By then it was almost dark, so they set up a perimeter, ate chow, then crawled under their ponchos and tried to settle in for the night. But the rain kept getting worse, and by midnight the field turned into soup. "Just this deep, oozy soup," he would have said. "Like sewage or something. Thick and mushy. You couldn't sleep. You couldn't even lie down, not for long, because you'd start to sink under the soup. Real clammy. You could feel the crud coming up inside your boots and pants." Here, Norman Bowker would have squinted against the low sun. He would have kept his voice cool, no self-pity. "But the worst part," he would have said quietly, "was the smell. Partly it was the river, a dead fish smell, but it was something else, too. Finally, somebody figured it out. What this was? It was a shit field. The village toilet. No indoor plumbing, right? So they used the field. I mean, we were camped in a goddamn shit field." He imagined Sally Kramer closing her eyes. If she were here with him in the car, she would have said, "Stop it. I don't like that word." "That's what it was." "All right, but you don't have to use that word." "Fine. What should we call it?" She would have glared at him.
"I don't know. Just stop it."
Clearly, he thought this was not a story for Sally Kramer. She was Sally Gustafson now. No doubt Max would have liked it, the irony in particular. But Max had become a pure idea, which was its own irony. It was just too bad. If his father were here, riding shotgun around the lake, the old man might have glanced over for a second, understanding perfectly well that it is not a question of offensive language, but of fact. His father would have sighed and folded his arms and waited. "A shit field," Norman Bowker would have said, "and later that night I could have won the Silver Star for valor."
"Right," his father would have murmured. "I hear you."
The Chevy rolled smoothly across a viaduct and up the narrow tar road. To the right was open lake. To the left, across the road, most of the lawns were scorched dry like October corn. Hopelessly, round and round, a rotating sprinkler scattered lake water on Dr. Mason's vegetable garden. Already the prairie had been baked dry, but in August it would get worse. The lake would turn green with algae, and the golf course would burn up, and the dragonflies would crack open for want of good water. The big Chevy curved past Centennial Beach and the A&W root beer stand. It was his 8th revolution around the lake. He followed the road past the handsome houses with their docks and wooden shingles, back to Slater Park, across the causeway, around to Sunset Park, as though riding on tracks. The two little boys were still trudging along on their 7-mile hike. Out on the lake, the man in the stalled motorboat still fiddled with his engine. The pair of mud hens floated like wooden decoys, and the water skiers looked tan and athletic, and the high school band was packing up its instruments, and the woman in pedal pushers patiently rebaited her hook for another try. Quaint, he thought. A hot summer day, and it was all very quaint and remote. The four workmen had almost completed their preparations for the evening fireworks. Facing the sun again, Norman Bowker decided it was nearly 7 o'clock. Not much later, the tired radio announcer confirmed it, his voice rocking itself into a deep Sunday snooze. If Max Arnold were here, he would say something about the announcer's fatigue and relate it to the bright pink in the sky and the war and courage. A pity that Max was gone, and a pity about his father, who had his own war and who now preferred silence. Still, there was so much to say. How the rain never stopped, how the cold worked into your bones. Sometimes the bravest thing on earth was to sit through the night and feel the cold in your bones. Courage was not always a matter of yes or no. Sometimes it came in degrees, like the cold. Sometimes you were very brave up to a point, and then beyond that point, you were not so brave. In certain situations, you can do incredible things. You could advance toward enemy fire. But in other situations, which were not nearly so bad, you had trouble keeping your eyes open. Sometimes, like that night in the shitfield, the difference between courage and cowardice was something small and stupid. The way the earth bubbled, and the smell. In a soft voice, without flourishes, he would have told the exact truth. "Late in the night," he would have said, "we took some mortar fire." He would have explained how it was still raining, and how the clouds were pasted to the field, and how the mortar rounds seemed to come right out of the clouds. Everything was black and wet. The field just exploded. Rain and slop and shrapnel, nowhere to run, and all they could do was worm down into slime and cover up and wait. He would have described the crazy things he saw, unnatural things, like how at one point he noticed a guy lying next to him in the sludge, completely buried except for his face, and how after a moment the guy rolled his eyes and winked at him. The noise was fierce, heavy thunder and mortar rounds and people yelling. Some of the men began shooting up flares, red and green and silver flares, all colors, and the rain came down in technicolor. The field was boiling. The shells made deep, slushy craters, opening up all those years of waste, centuries worth, and the smell came bubbling out of the earth. 2 rounds hit close by, then a third even closer, and immediately, off to his left, he heard somebody screaming. It was Kiowa. He knew that. The sound was ragged and clotted up, but even so he knew the voice. A strange gargling noise. Rolling sideways, he crawled toward the screaming in the dark. The rain was hard and steady. Along the perimeter there were quick bursts of gunfire. Another round hit nearby, spraying up shit and water, and for a few moments he ducked down beneath the mud. He heard the valves in his heart. He heard the quick feathering action of the hinges. Extraordinary, he thought. As he came up, a pair of red flares puffed open, a soft, blurry glow, and in the glow he saw Kiowa's wide-open eyes settling down into the scum. All he could do was watch. He heard himself moan. Then he moved again, crabbing forward. But when he got there, Kiowa was almost completely under. There was a knee, there was an arm, and a gold wristwatch, and part of a boot. He could not describe what happened next. Not ever. But he would have tried anyway. He would have spoken carefully so as to make it real for anyone who would listen. There were bubbles where Kiowa's head should have been. The left hand was curled open. The fingers were filthy. The wristwatch gave off a green phosphorescent shine as it slipped beneath the thick waters. He would have talked about this, how he grabbed Kiowa by the boot and tried to pull him out. He pulled hard, but Kiowa was gone. And then suddenly he felt himself going, too. The shit was in his nose and eyes. There were flares and mortar rounds, and the stink was everywhere. It was inside him, in his lungs, and he could no longer tolerate it. Not here, he thought. Not like this. He released Kiowa's boot and watched it slide away. Slowly, working his way up, he hoisted himself out of the deep mud. And then he lay still and tasted the shit in his mouth, and closed his eyes and listened to the rain and explosions and bubbling sounds. He was alone. He had lost his weapon, but it didn't matter. All he wanted was a bath. Nothing else. A hot, soapy bath. Circling the lake, Norman Bowker remembered how his friend Kiowa had disappeared under the waste and water. "I didn't flip out," he would have said. "I was cool. If things had gone right, if it hadn't been for that smell, I could have won the Silver Star." A good war story, he thought, but it was not a war for war stories, nor for talk of valor, and nobody in town wanted to know about the terrible stink. They wanted good intentions and good deeds, but the town was not to blame, really. It was a nice little town, very prosperous, with neat houses and all the sanitary conveniences. Norman Bowker lit a cigarette and cranked open his window. 7:35, he decided. The lake had divided into two halves. One half still glistened, the other was caught in shadow. Along the causeway, the two little boys marched on. The man in the stalled motorboat yanked frantically on the cord to his engine, and the two mud hens sought supper at the bottom of the lake, tails bobbing. He passed Sunset Park once again, and more houses, and the junior college and the tennis courts, and the picnickers who now sat waiting for the evening fireworks. The high school band was gone. The woman in pedal pushers patiently toyed with her line. Although it was not yet dusk, the A&W was already awash in neon lights. He maneuvered his father's Chevy into one of the parking slots, let the engine idle, and sat back. The place was doing a good holiday business, mostly kids, it seemed, and a few farmers in for the day. He did not recognize any of the faces. A slim, hipless young car hop passed by, but when he hit the horn, she did not seem to notice. Her eyes slid sideways. She hooked a tray to the window of a Firebird, laughing lightly, leaning forward to chat with the three boys inside. He felt invisible in the soft twilight. Straight ahead, over the takeout counter, swarms of mosquitoes electrocuted themselves against the aluminum pest-rid machine. It was a calm, quiet summer evening. He honked again, this time leaning on the horn. The young car hop turned slowly, as if puzzled, then said something to the boys in the Firebird and moved reluctantly toward him. Pinned to her shirt was a badge that said, "Eat Mama Burgers." When she reached his window, she stood straight up so that all he could see was the badge. "Mama Burger," he said. "Maybe some fries, too?" The girl sighed, leaned down, and shook her head. Her eyes were as fluffy and airy light as cotton candy. "You blind?" she said. She put out her hand and tapped an intercom attached to a steel post. "Punch the button and place your order. All I do is carry the dumb trays." She stared at him for a moment. Briefly, he thought, a question lingered in her fuzzy eyes, but then she turned and punched the button for him and returned to her friends in the Firebird. The intercom squeaked and said, "Order." "Mama Burger and fries," Norman Bowker said. "Affirmative, copy clear. No Rudy Tooty?" Rudy Tooty? "You know, man, root beer." A small one. "Roger Dodger, repeat, one mama, one fries, one small beer. Fire for effect, stand by." The intercom squeaked and went dead. "Out," said Norman Bowker. When the girl brought his tray, he ate quickly without looking up. The tired radio announcer in Des Moines gave the time, almost 8:30. Dark was pressing in tight now, and he wished there were somewhere to go. In the morning, he'd check out job possibilities, shoot a few buckets down at the Y, maybe wash the Chevy. He finished his root beer and pushed the intercom button. "Order," said the tinny voice. "All done." "That's it?" "I guess so." "Hey, loosen up," the voice said. "What you really need, friend?" Norman Bowker smiled. "Well," he said, "how'd you like to hear about..." He stopped and shook his head. "Hear what, man?" "Nothing." "Well, hey," the intercom said, "I'm sure as fuck not going anywhere. Screwed to a post, for God's sake. Go ahead and try me." "Nothing." "You sure?"
Positive. All done. The intercom made a slight sound of disappointment.
Your choice, I guess. Over and out.
Out, said Norman Bowker. On his 10th turn around the lake, he passed the hiking boys for the last time. The man in the stalled motorboat was gone. The mud hens were gone. Beyond the lake, over Sally Gustafson's house, the sun had left a smudge of purple on the horizon. The bandshell was deserted, and the woman in petal pushers quietly reeled in her line, and Dr. Mason's sprinkler went round and round. On his 11th revolution, he switched off the air conditioning, opened up his window, and rested his elbow comfortably on the sill, driving with one hand. There was nothing to say. He could not talk about it and never would. The evening was smooth and warm. If it had been possible, which it wasn't, he would have explained how his friend Kiowa slipped away that night beneath the dark swampy field. He was folded in with the war. He was part of the waste. Turning on his headlights, driving slowly, Norman Bowker remembered how he had taken hold of Kiowa's boot and pulled hard, but how the smell was simply too much, and how he backed off, and in that way had lost the Silver Star. He wished he could have explained some of this, how he had been braver than he ever thought possible, but how he had not been so brave as he wanted to be. The distinction was important. Max Arnold, who loved fine lines, would have appreciated it, and his father, who already knew, would have nodded. The truth, Norman Bowker would have said, is I let the guy go.
Maybe he was already gone.
He wasn't.
But maybe.
No, I could feel it. He wasn't. Some things you can feel.
His father would have been quiet for a while, watching the headlights against the narrow tar road. Well, anyway, the old man would have said, there's still the 7 medals.
I suppose.
7 honeys.
Right.
On his 12th revolution, the sky went crazy with color. He pulled into Sunset Park and stopped in the shadow of a picnic shelter. After a time he got out, walked down to the beach. He waded into the lake without undressing. The water felt warm against his skin. He put his head under. He opened his lips, very slightly, for the taste. Then he stood up and folded his arms and watched the fireworks. For a small town, he decided, it was a pretty good show. Notes. Speaking of Courage was written in 1975 at the suggestion of Norman Bowker, who 3 years later hanged himself in the locker room of a YMCA in his hometown in central Iowa. In the spring of 1975, near the time of Saigon's final collapse, I received a long, disjointed letter in which Bowker described the problem of finding a meaningful use for his life after the war. He had worked briefly as an automotive parts salesman, a janitor, a car wash attendant, and a short-order cook at the local A&W fast food franchise. None of these jobs, he said, had lasted more than 10 weeks. He lived with his parents, who supported him, and who treated him with kindness and obvious love. At one point he had enrolled in the junior college in his hometown, but the coursework, he said, seemed too abstract, too distant, with nothing real or tangible at stake, certainly not the stakes of a war. He dropped out after 8 months. He spent his mornings in bed. In the afternoons he played pickup basketball at the Y, and then at night he drove around town in his father's car, mostly alone, or with a six-pack of beer, cruising.
The thing is, he wrote, there's no place to go. Not just in this lousy little town. In general. My life, I mean. It's almost like I got killed over in Nam. Hard to describe. That night when Kiowa got wasted, I sort of sank down into the sewage with him. Feels like I'm still in deep shit.
The letter covered 17 handwritten pages, its tone jumping from self-pity to anger to irony to guilt to a kind of feigned indifference. He didn't know what to feel. In the middle of the letter, for example, he reproached himself for complaining too much.
God, this is starting to sound like some jerk-off vet crying in his beer. Sorry about that.
I'm no basket case, not even any bad dreams. And I don't feel like anybody mistreats me or anything, except sometimes people act too nice, too polite, like they're afraid they might ask the wrong question. But I shouldn't bitch. One thing I hate, really hate, is all those whiner vets, guys sniveling about how they didn't get any parades. Such absolute crap. I mean, who in his right mind wants a parade? Or getting his back clapped by a bunch of patriotic idiots who don't know jack about what it feels like to kill people or get shot at or sleep in the rain or watch your buddy go down underneath the mud. Who needs it? Anyhow, I'm basically A-okay, home free. So why not come down for a visit sometime? And we'll chase pussy and shoot the breeze and tell each other old war lies. A good long bull session, you know? I felt it coming, and near the end of the letter, it came. He explained that he had read my first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, which he liked except for the bleeding heart political parts. For half a page, he talked about how much the book had meant to him, how it brought back all kinds of memories, the Vills and Paddies and Rivers, and how he recognized most of the characters, including himself, even though almost all of the names were changed. Then Bowker came straight out with it. What you should do, Tim, is write a story about a guy who feels like he got zapped over in that shithole, a guy who can't get his act together and just drives around town all day and can't think of any damn place to go and doesn't know how to get there anyway. This guy wants to talk about it, but he can't. If you want, you can use the stuff in this letter, but not my real name, okay? I'd write it myself, except I can't ever find any words, if you know what I mean. And I can't figure out what exactly to say. Something about the feel that night, the way Kiowa just disappeared into the crud. You were there. You can tell it. Norman Bowker's letter hit me hard. For years I'd felt a certain smugness about how easily I'd made the shift from war to peace. A nice, smooth glide. No flashbacks or midnight sweats. The war was over, after all, and the thing to do was go on. So I took pride in sliding gracefully from Vietnam to graduate school, from Kongai to Harvard, from one world to another. In ordinary conversation, I never spoke much about the war, certainly not in detail, and yet ever since my return, I had been talking about it virtually nonstop through my writing. Telling stories seemed a natural, inevitable process, like clearing the throat. Partly catharsis, partly communication. It was a way of grabbing people by the shirt and explaining exactly what had happened to me, how I had allowed myself to get dragged into a wrong war, all the mistakes I'd made, all the terrible things I had seen and done. I did not look on my work as therapy, and still don't. Yet when I received Norman Bowker's letter, it occurred to me that the act of writing had led me through a swirl of memories that might otherwise have ended in paralysis, or worse. By telling stories, you objectify your own experience. You separate it from yourself. You pin down certain truths, you make up others. You start sometimes with an incident that truly happened, like the night in the shitfield, and you carry it forward by inventing incidents that did not in fact occur, but that nonetheless helped to clarify and explain. In any case, Norman Bowker's letter had an effect. It haunted me for more than a month, not the word so much as its desperation, and I resolved finally to take him up on his story suggestion. At the time, I was at work on a new novel, going after Cacciato, and one morning I sat down and began a chapter titled Speaking of Courage. The emotional core came directly from Bowker's letter, the simple need to talk. To provide a dramatic frame, I collapsed events into a single time and place, a car circling a lake on a quiet afternoon in midsummer, using the lake as a nucleus around which the story would orbit. As he'd requested, I did not use Norman Bowker's name, instead substituting the name of my novel's main character, Paul Berlin. For the scenery, I borrowed heavily from my own hometown, wholesale thievery, in fact. I lifted up Worthington, Minnesota, the lake, the road, the causeway, the woman in pedal pushers, the junior college, the handsome houses and docks and boats and public parks, and carried it all a few hundred miles south and transplanted it onto the Iowa prairie. The writing went quickly and easily. I drafted the piece in a week or two, fiddled with it for another week, then published it as a separate short story. Almost immediately, though, there was a sense of failure. The details of Norman Bowker's story were missing. In this original version, which I still conceived as part of the novel, I had been forced to omit the shitfield and the rain and the death of Kiowa, replacing this material with events that better fit the book's narrative. As a consequence, I had lost the natural counterpoint between the lake and the field. A metaphoric unity was broken. What the piece needed and did not have was the terrible killing power of that shitfield. As the novel developed over the next year, and as my own ideas clarified, it became apparent that the chapter had no proper home in the larger narrative. Going After Cacciato was a war story. Speaking of Courage was a post-war story. Two different time periods, two different sets of issues. There was no choice but to remove the chapter entirely. The mistake, in part, had been in trying to wedge the piece into a novel. Beyond that, though, something about the story had frightened me. I was afraid to speak directly, afraid to remember, and in the end, the piece had been ruined by a failure to tell the full and precise truth about our night in the shitfield. Over the next several months, as it often happens, I managed to erase the story's flaws from my memory, taking pride in a shadowy, idealized recollection of its virtues. When the piece appeared in an anthology of short fiction, I sent a copy off to Norman Bowker with the thought that it might please him. His reaction was short and somewhat bitter. "It's not terrible," he wrote me, "but you left out Vietnam. Where's Kiowa? Where's the shit?" 8 months later, he hanged himself. In August of 1978, his mother sent me a brief note explaining what had happened. He had been playing pickup basketball at the Y. After 2 hours, he went off for a drink of water. He used a jump rope. His friends found him hanging from a water pipe. There was no suicide note, no message of any kind. "Norman was a quiet boy," his mother wrote, "and I don't suppose he wanted to bother anybody." Now, a decade after his death, I'm hoping that Speaking of Courage makes good on Norman Bowker's silence. And I hope it's a better story. Although the old structure remains, the piece has been substantially revised, in some places by severe cutting, in other places by the addition of new material. Norman is back in the story, where he belongs, and I don't think he'd mind that his real name appears. The central incident, our long night in the shitfield along the Songtra Bong, has been restored to the piece. It was hard stuff to write. Kiowa, after all, had been a close friend, and for years I've avoided thinking about his death and my own complicity in it. Even here, it's not easy. In the interests of truth, however, I want to make it clear that Norman Bowker was in no way responsible for what happened to Kiowa. Norman did not experience a failure of nerve that night. He did not freeze up or lose the Silver Star for valor. That part of the story is my own. In the Field. At daybreak, the platoon of 18 soldiers formed into a loose rank and began tramping side by side through the deep muck of the shitfield. They moved slowly in the rain. Leaning forward, heads down, they used the butts of their weapons as probes, wading across the field to the river, and then turning and wading back again. They were tired and miserable. All they wanted now was to get it finished. Kiowa was gone. He was under the mud and water, folded into the war, and their only thought was to find him and dig him out and then move on to some place dry and warm. It had been a hard night, maybe the worst ever. The rains had fallen without stop, and the Songtra Bong had overflowed its banks, and the muck had now risen thigh-deep in the field along the river. A low gray mist hovered over the land. Off to the west there was thunder, soft little moaning sounds, and the monsoons seemed to be a lasting element of the war. The 18 soldiers moved in silence. First Lieutenant Jimmy Cross went first, now and then straightening out the rank, closing up the gaps. His uniform was dark with mud. His arms and face were filthy. Early in the morning, he had radioed in the MIA report, giving the name and circumstances. But he was now determined to find his man, no matter what, even if it meant flying in slabs of concrete and damming up the river and draining the entire field. He would not lose a member of his command like this. It wasn't right. Kiowa had been a fine soldier and a fine human being, a devout Baptist, and there was no way Lieutenant Cross would allow such a good man to be lost under the slime of a shitfield. Briefly, he stopped and watched the clouds. Except for some occasional thunder, it was a deeply quiet morning, just the rain and the steady sloshing sounds of 18 men wading through the thick waters. Lieutenant Cross wished the rain would let up. Even for an hour, it would make things easier. But then he shrugged. The rain was the war, and you had to fight it. Turning, he looked out across the field and yelled at one of his men to close up the rank. Not a man, really. A boy. The young soldier stood off by himself at the center of the field in knee-deep water, reaching down with both hands as if chasing some object just beneath the surface. The boy's shoulders were shaking. Jimmy Cross yelled again, but the young soldier did not turn or look up. In his hooded poncho, everything caked with mud, the boy's face was impossible to make out. The filth seemed to erase identities, transforming the men into identical copies of a single soldier, which was exactly how Jimmy Cross had been trained to treat them, as interchangeable units of command. It was difficult sometimes, but he tried to avoid that sort of thinking. He had no military ambitions. He preferred to view his men not as units but as human beings, and Kyle had been a splendid human being, the very best, intelligent and gentle, quiet-spoken. Very brave, too, and decent. The kid's father taught Sunday school in Oklahoma City, where Kiowa had been raised to believe in the promise of salvation under Jesus Christ, and this conviction had always been present in the boy's smile, in his posture toward the world, in the way he never went anywhere without an illustrated New Testament that his father had mailed to him as a birthday present back in January. A crime, Jimmy Cross thought. Looking out toward the river, he knew for a fact that he had made a mistake setting up here. The order had come from higher, true, but still he should have exercised some field discretion. He should have moved to higher ground for the night, should have radioed in false coordinates. There was nothing he could do now, but still it was a mistake and a hideous waste. He felt sick about it. Standing in the deep waters of the field, First Lieutenant Jimmy Cross began composing a letter in his head to the kid's father. Not mentioning the shitfield, just saying what a fine soldier Kiowa had been, what a fine human being, and how he was the kind of son that any father could be proud of forever. The search went slowly. For a time the morning seemed to brighten, the sky going to a lighter shade of silver, but then the rains came back hard and steady. There was a feel of permanent twilight. At the far left of the line, Azar and Norman Bowker and Mitchell Sanders waited along the edge of the field closest to the river. They were all tall men, but at times the muck came to mid-thigh, other times to the crotch. Azar kept shaking his head. He coughed and he shook his head and said, "Man, talk about irony. I bet if Kiowa was here, I bet he'd just laugh. Eating shit. It's your classic irony." "Fine," said Norman Bowker. "Now pipe down." Azar sighed. "Wasted in the waste," he said. "A shitfield, you gotta admit. It's pure world-class irony." The three men moved with slow, heavy steps. It was hard to keep balance. Their boots sank into the ooze, which produced a powerful downward suction, and with each step they would have to pull up hard to break the hold. The rain made quick dents in the water, like tiny mouths, and the stink was everywhere. When they reached the river, they shifted a few meters to the north and began wading back up the field. Occasionally they used their weapons to test the bottom, but mostly they just searched with their feet. "A classic case," Azar was saying. "Biting the dirt, so to speak. That tells the story." "Enough," Bowker said.
Like those old cowboy movies. One more redskin bites the dirt. I'm serious, man. Zip it shut.
Azar smiled and said,
Classic.
The morning was cold and wet. They had not slept during the night, not even for a few moments, and all three of them were feeling the tension as they moved across the field toward the river. There was nothing they could do for Kiowa. Just find him and slide him aboard a chopper. Whenever a man died, it was always the same. A desire to get it over with, quickly, no frills or ceremony. And what they wanted now was to head for a vill and get under a roof and forget what had happened during the night. Halfway across the field, Mitchell Sanders stopped. He stood for a moment with his eyes shut, feeling along the bottom with a foot. Then he passed his weapon over to Norman Bowker and reached down into the muck. After a second, he hauled up a scummy green rucksack. The three men did not speak for a time. The pack was heavy with mud and water, dead-looking. Inside were a pair of moccasins and an illustrated New Testament. Well, Mitchell Sanders finally said, the guy's around here somewhere.
Better tell the LT.
Screw him.
Yeah, but some lieutenant, Sanders said, camps us in a toilet. Man don't know shit.
Nobody knew, Bowker said.
Maybe so, maybe not. 10 billion places we could have set up last night, the man picks a latrine.
Norman Bowker stared down at the rucksack. It was made of dark green nylon with an aluminum frame, but now it had the curious look of flesh.
It wasn't the LT's fault, Bowker said quietly.
Whose then?
Nobody's. Nobody knew till afterward. Mitchell Sanders made a sound in his throat. He hoisted up the rucksack, slipped into the harness, and pulled the straps tight.
All right, but this much for sure. The man knew it was raining. He knew about the river. One plus one. Add it up. You get exactly what happened.
Sanders glared at the river.
Move it, he said. Kaya was waiting on us.
Slowly then, bending against the rain, Azar and Norman Bowker and Mitchell Sanders began wading again through the deep waters, their eyes down, circling out from where they had found the rucksack. First Lieutenant Jimmy Cross stood 50 meters away. He had finished writing the letter in his head, explaining things to Kiowa's father, and now he folded his arms and watched his platoon crisscrossing the wide field. In a funny way, it reminded him of the municipal golf course in his hometown in New Jersey. A lost ball, he thought. Tired players searching through the rough, sweeping back and forth in long systematic patterns. He wished he were there right now. On the sixth hole, looking out across the water hazard that fronted the small flat green, a 7-iron in his hand, calculating wind and distance, wondering if he should reach instead for an 8. A tough decision. But all you could ever lose was a ball. You did not lose a player, and you never had to wade out into the hazard and spend the day searching through the slime. Jimmy Cross did not want the responsibility of leading these men. He had never wanted it. In his sophomore year at Mount Sebastian College, he had signed up for the Reserve Officer Training Corps without much thought. An automatic thing, because his friends had joined, and because it was worth a few credits. And because it seemed preferable to letting the draft take him. He was unprepared. 24 years old and his heart wasn't in it. Military matters meant nothing to him. He did not care one way or the other about the war, and he had no desire to command. And even after all these months in the bush, all the days and nights, even then he did not know enough to keep his men out of a shit field. What he should have done, he told himself, was follow his first impulse. In the late afternoon yesterday, when they reached the night coordinates, he should have taken one look and headed for higher ground. No excuses. At one edge of the field was a small vill, and right away a couple of old mamasans had trotted out to warn him.
Number 10, they said. Evil ground.
But it was a war, and he had his orders. So they'd set up a perimeter and crawled under their ponchos and tried to settle in for the night. He remembered how the water kept rising, how a terrible stink began to swell up out of the earth. It was a dead fish smell, partly, but something else, too. And then late in the night, Mitchell Sanders had crawled through the rain and grabbed him hard by the arm and asked him what he was doing setting up in a shit field. "The village toilet," Sanders said. He remembered the look on Sanders' face. The guy stared for a moment and then wiped his mouth and whispered, "Shit," and then crawled away into the dark. A stupid mistake. That's all it was, a mistake. But it had killed Kiowa. Lieutenant Jimmy Cross felt something tighten inside him. In the letter to Kiowa's father, he would apologize point blank, just admit to the blunders. He would place the blame where it belonged. Tactically, he said, it was indefensible ground from the start. Low and flat, no natural cover. And so late in the night, when they took mortar fire from across the river, all they could do was snake down under the slop and lie there and wait. The field just exploded. Rain and slop and shrapnel. It all mixed together, and the field seemed to boil. He would explain this to Kiowa's father. Carefully, not covering up his own guilt, he would tell how the mortar rounds made craters in the slush, spraying up great showers of filth, and how the craters then collapsed on themselves and filled up with mud and water, sucking things down, swallowing things, weapons and entrenching tools and belts of ammunition, and how in this way his son, Kiowa, had been combined with the waste and the war. "My own fault," he would say. Straightening up, First Lieutenant Jimmy Cross rubbed his eyes and tried to get his thoughts together. The rain fell in a cold, sad drizzle. Off toward the river, he again noticed the young soldier standing alone at the center of the field. The boy's shoulders were shaking. Maybe it was something in the posture of the soldier, or the way he seemed to be reaching for some invisible object beneath the surface. But for several moments, Jimmy Cross stood very still, afraid to move, yet knowing he had to. And then he murmured to himself, "My fault." And he nodded and waded out across the field toward the boy. The young soldier was trying hard not to cry. He, too, blamed himself. Bent forward at the waist, groping with both hands, he seemed to be chasing some creature just beyond reach, something elusive, a fish or a frog. His lips were moving. Like Jimmy Cross, the boy was explaining things to an absent judge. It wasn't to defend himself. The boy recognized his own guilt and wanted only to lay out the full causes. Wading sideways a few steps, he leaned down and felt along the soft bottom of the field. He pictured Kiowa's face. They'd been close buddies, the tightest, and he remembered how last night they had huddled together under their ponchos, the rain cold and steady, the water rising to their knees, but how Kiowa had just laughed it off and said they should concentrate on better things. And so for a long while they talked about their families and hometowns. At one point, the boy remembered, he'd been showing Kiowa a picture of his girlfriend. He remembered switching on his flashlight, a stupid thing to do, but he did it anyway. And he remembered Kiowa leaning in for a look at the picture. "Hey, she's cute," he had said. And then the field exploded all around them. Like murder, the boy thought. The flashlight made it happen, dumb and dangerous, and as a result his friend Kiowa was dead. That simple, he thought. He wished there were some other way to look at it, but there wasn't. Very simple and very final. He remembered two mortar rounds hitting close by, then a third even closer, and off to his left he had heard somebody scream. The voice was ragged and clotted up, but he knew instantly that it was Kiowa. He remembered trying to crawl toward the screaming. No sense of direction, though. And the field seemed to suck him under, and everything was black and wet, and he couldn't get his bearings. And then another round hit nearby, and for a few moments all he could do was hold his breath and duck down beneath the water. Later, when he came up again, there were no more screams. There was an arm and a wristwatch and part of a boot. There were bubbles where Kiowa's head should have been. He remembered grabbing the boot. He remembered pulling hard, but how the field seemed to pull back, like a tug-of-war he couldn't win, and how finally he had to whisper his friend's name and let go, and watch the boot slide away. Then for a long time, there were things he could not remember, various sounds, various smells. Later, he found himself lying on a little rise, face up, tasting the field in his mouth, listening to the rain and explosions and bubbling sounds. He was alone. He'd lost everything. He'd lost Kiowa, and his weapon, and his flashlight, and his girlfriend's picture. He remembered this. He remembered wondering if he could lose himself. Now, in the dull morning rain, the boy seemed frantic. He waded quickly from spot to spot, leaning down and plunging his hands into the water. He did not look up when Lieutenant Jimmy Cross approached. "Right here," the boy was saying. "Got to be right here." Jimmy Cross remembered the kid's face, but not the name. That happens sometimes. He tried to treat his men as individuals, but sometimes the names just escaped him. He watched the young soldier shove his hands into the water. "Right here," he kept saying. His movements seemed random and jerky. Jimmy Cross waited a moment, then stepped closer. "Listen," he said quietly. "The guy could be anywhere." The boy glanced up.
"Who could?"
"Kiowa. You can't expect..."
"Kiowa's dead."
"Well, yes." The young soldier nodded.
"So what about Billy?"
"Who?"
"My girl. What about her? This picture, it was the only one I had. Right here, I lost it."
Jimmy Cross shook his head. It bothered him that he could not come up with a name. "Slow down," he said.
I don't... "Billy's picture. I had it all wrapped up. I had it in plastic. So it'll be okay if I can... Last night, we were looking at it, me and Kiowa, right here. I know for sure it's right here somewhere."
Jimmy Cross smiled at the boy. "You can ask her for another one, a better one."
"She won't send another one. She's not even my girl anymore. She won't... Man, I gotta find it."
The boy yanked his arm free. He shuffled sideways and stooped down again and dipped into the muck with both hands. His shoulders were shaking. Briefly, Lieutenant Cross wondered where the kid's weapon was and his helmet, but it seemed better not to ask. He felt some pity come on him. For a moment, the day seemed to soften. "So much hurt," he thought. He watched the young soldier wading through the water, bending down, and then standing, and then bending down again, as if something might finally be salvaged from all the waste. Jimmy Cross silently wished the boy luck. Then he closed his eyes and went back to working on the letter to Kiowa's father. Across the field, Azar and Norman Bowker and Mitchell Sanders were waiting alongside a narrow dike at the edge of the field. It was near noon now. Norman Bowker found Kiowa. He was under 2 feet of water. Nothing showed except the heel of a boot.
"That's him," Azar said.
"Who else?"
"I don't know," Azar shook his head. "I don't know."
Norman Bowker touched the boot, covered his eyes for a moment, then stood up and looked at Azar. "So where's the joke?" he said.
"No joke."
"Eating shit. Let's hear that one."
"Forget it."
Mitchell Sanders told him to knock it off. The three soldiers moved to the dike, put down their packs and weapons, then waded back to where the boot was showing. The body lay partly wedged under a layer of mud beneath the water. It was hard to get traction. With each movement, the muck would grip their feet and hold tight. The rain had come back harder now. Mitchell Sanders reached down and found Kiowa's other boot, and they waited a moment. Then Sanders sighed and said,
"Okay."
And they took hold of the two boots and pulled up hard. There was only a slight give. They tried again, but this time the body did not move at all. After the third try, they stopped and looked down for a while. "One more time," Norman Bowker said. He counted to three, and they leaned back and pulled.
"Stuck,"
said Mitchell Sanders.
"I see that. Christ."
They tried again, then called over Henry Dobbins and Rat Kiley, and all five of them put their arms and backs into it, but the body was jammed in tight. Azar moved to the dike and sat holding his stomach. His face was pale. The others stood in a circle, watching the water, Then after a time, somebody said, "We can't just leave him there." And the men nodded and got out their entrenching tools and began digging. It was hard, sloppy work. The mud seemed to flow back faster than they could dig, but Kiowa was their friend, and they kept at it anyway. Slowly, in little groups, the rest of the platoon drifted over to watch. Only Lieutenant Jimmy Cross and the young soldier were still searching the field.
"What we should do, I guess," Norman Bowker said, "is tell the LT."
Mitchell Sanders shook his head.
"Just mess things up. Besides, the man looks happy out there, real content. Let him be."
After 10 minutes, they uncovered most of Kiowa's lower body. The corpse was angled steeply into the muck, upside down, like a diver who had plunged headfirst off a high tower. The men stood quietly for a few seconds. There was a feeling of awe. Mitchell Sanders finally nodded and said, "Let's get it done." And they took hold of the legs and pulled up hard, then pulled again, and after a moment, Kiowa came sliding to the surface. A piece of his shoulder was missing. The arms and chest and face were cut up with shrapnel. He was covered with bluish-green mud.
"Well," Henry Dobbin said, "could be worse."
And Dave Jensen said,
"How, man? Tell me how."
Carefully, trying not to look at the body, they carried Kiowa over to the dike and laid him down. They used towels to clean off the scum. Rat Kiley went through the kid's pockets, placed his personal effects in a plastic bag, taped the bag to Kiowa's wrist, then used the radio to call in a dust-off. Moving away, the men found things to do with themselves, some smoking, some opening up cans of sea rations, a few just standing in the rain. For all of them, it was a relief to have it finished. There was the promise of now finding a hooch somewhere, or an abandoned pagoda, where they could strip down and wring out their fatigues and maybe start a hot fire. They felt bad for Kiowa, but they also felt a kind of giddiness, a secret joy, because they were alive, and because even the rain was preferable to being sucked under a shitfield, and because it was all a matter of luck and happenstance.
Azar sat down on the dike next to Norman Bowker.
"Listen," he said, "those dumb jokes, I didn't mean anything."
"We all say things."
"Yeah, but when I saw the guy, it made me feel, I don't know, like he was listening."
"He wasn't."
"I guess not, but I felt sort of guilty almost. Like if I'd kept my mouth shut, none of it would have ever happened. Like it was my fault."
Norman Bowker looked out across the wet field.
"Nobody's fault," he said. "Everybody's."
Near the center of the field, First Lieutenant Jimmy Cross squatted in the muck, almost entirely submerged. In his head, he was revising the letter to Kiowa's father. Impersonal this time. An officer expressing an officer's condolences. No apologies were necessary, because in fact it was one of those freak things. And the war was full of freaks, and nothing could ever change it anyway. Which was the truth, he thought. The exact truth. Lieutenant Cross went deeper into the muck, the dark water at his throat, and tried to tell himself it was the truth. Beside him, a few steps off to the left, the young soldier was still searching for his girlfriend's picture, still remembering how he had killed Kiowa. The boy wanted to confess. He wanted to tell the lieutenant how, in the middle of the night, he had pulled out Billy's picture and passed it over to Kiowa, and then switched on a flashlight, and how Kiowa had whispered, "Hey, she's cute," and how for a second the flashlight had made Billy's face sparkle, and how right then the field had exploded all around them. The flashlight had done it, like a target shining in the dark. The boy looked up at the sky, then at Jimmy Cross.
"Sir?"
he said. The rain and mist moved across the field in broad, sweeping sheets of gray. Close by there was thunder.
"Sir?" the boy said. "I gotta explain something."
But Lieutenant Jimmy Cross wasn't listening. Eyes closed, he let himself go deeper into the waste, just letting the field take him. He laid back and floated. When a man died, there had to be blame. Jimmy Cross understood this. You could blame the war. You could blame the idiots who made the war. You could blame Kiowa for going to it. You could blame the rain, You could blame the river. You could blame the field, the mud, the climate. You could blame the enemy. You could blame the mortar rounds. You could blame people who were too lazy to read a newspaper, who were bored by the daily body counts, who switched channels at the mention of politics. You could blame whole nations. You could blame God. You could blame the munitions makers or Karl Marx or a trick of fate or an old man in Omaha who forgot to vote. In the field, though, the causes were immediate. A moment of carelessness or bad judgment or plain stupidity carried consequences that lasted forever. For a long while, Jimmy Cross lay floating. In the clouds to the east, there was the sound of a helicopter, but he did not take notice. With his eyes still closed, bobbing in the field, he let himself slip away. He was back home in New Jersey, a golden afternoon on the golf course, the fairways lush and green, and he was teeing it up on the first hole. It was a world without responsibility. When the war was over, he thought, maybe then he would write a letter to Kiowa's father. Or maybe not. Maybe he would just take a couple of practice swings and knock the ball down the middle and pick up his clubs and walk off into the afternoon. Good form. It's time to be blunt. I'm 43 years old, true, and I'm a writer now, and a long time ago I walked through Quang Gai province as a foot soldier. Almost everything else is invented. But it's not a game, it's a form. Right here, now, as I invent myself, I'm thinking of all I want to tell you about why this book is written as it is. For instance, I want to tell you this. 20 years ago, I watched a man die on a trail near the village of Mikkei. I did not kill him, but I was present, you see, and my presence was guilt enough. I remember his face, which was not a pretty face, because his jaw was in his throat, and I remember feeling the burden of responsibility and grief. I blamed myself, and rightly so, because I was present. But listen, even that story is made up. I want you to feel what I felt. I want you to know why story truth is truer sometimes than happening truth. Here is the happening truth. I was once a soldier. There were many bodies, with real faces, but I was young then, and I was afraid to look. And now, 20 years later, I'm left with faceless responsibility and faceless grief. Here is the story truth. He was a slim, dead, almost dainty young man of about 20. He lay in the center of a red clay trail near the village of Mikkei. His jaw was in his throat. His one eye was shut. The other eye was a star-shaped hole. I killed him. What stories can do, I guess, is make things present. I can look at things I never looked at. I can attach faces to grief and love and pity and God. I can be brave. I can make myself feel again. Daddy, tell the truth, Kathleen can say. Did you ever kill anybody? And I can say honestly, of course not. Or I can say honestly, yes. Field trip. A few months after completing In the Field, I returned with my daughter to Vietnam, where we visited the site of Kiowa's death, and where I looked for signs of forgiveness, or personal grace, or whatever else the land might offer. The field was still there, though not as I remembered it. Much smaller, I thought, and not nearly so menacing. And in the bright sunlight, it was hard to picture what had happened on this ground some 20 years ago. Except for a few marshy spots along the river, everything was bone dry. No ghosts, just a flat, grassy field. The place was at peace. There were yellow butterflies. There was a breeze and a wide blue sky. Along the river, two old farmers stood in ankle-deep water, repairing the same narrow dike where we had laid out Kiowa's body after pulling him from the muck. Things were quiet. At one point, I remember, one of the farmers looked up and shaded his eyes, staring across the field at us. Then, after a time, he wiped his forehead and went back to work. I stood with my arms folded, feeling the grip of sentiment and time.